Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, I'm in Woodmead in Johannesburg today to chat to the CEO and the chairman of Huge Group, James Herbst and Dr. Duarte da Silva. Huge Group, which is listed on the JSE, has been intriguing me for a while now. The company's share price has shot up in the past 3 years, and it's been hiring some top industry figures to join its board and leadership team. Names such as Duarte da Silva, who we're chatting to today. Duarte is a former top-rated Merrill Lynch analyst. And that's where I first met him, when he was putting out the most comprehensive reports on technology companies with names like QData and Persatel, which of course merged eventually. He's also the former CEO of the financial services business Macquarie First South, and he was appointed as Huge Group's chairman in 2016. But there are other heavy hitters who have joined the board, including former MTN South Africa CEO Zunaid Babulia, who is now Huge Group's chief financial officer. And recently, former Telkom Chief Commercial Officer Brian Armstrong joined Huge's board as a non-executive director. James, Duarte, thank you so much for joining us on Tech Central today.
Thanks for having us.
James, why are you pointing all these heavy hitters?
Because we have a particularly exciting piece of canvas, and we need some very good painters to paint that canvas. And so we want the best. And given the quality of the canvas that we have, I think we've been able to attract the quality painters out there.
Okay. Duarte, you've had quite a storied career up to this point, if I can call it that. I remember reading those brilliantly illustrated and expertly written reports that you did in the 1990s when you were at Merrill Lynch. But you went on to a career after that in financial services with Macquarie. If you don't mind, take us through that period leading up to your joining Huge Group last year.
I actually left Merrill Lynch in 1998 to found a private equity business called Tata, which merged with McCarthy Bank. Cyril Ramaphosa landed being our chairman. So we landed up doing 22 investments in the technology arena, and that was from 1998 to 2001. Then joined the J&J Group in 2002, literally to help them as chief investment officer. But after some discussions with them, we decided to found our own financial services business, which was called First South. We were fortunate in that Credit Suisse First Boston was extracting itself from South Africa. So we bought that from them in 2002 and used it as the foundation of setting up our own financial services business, which was largely involved in stockbroking, corporate finance, and private equity. Subsequently, we then also bought into asset management. 2005, we attracted Macquarie to come and replace Credit Suisse as our international partner, and we did a joint venture with them called Macquarie First South, specifically in the corporate finance and stockbroking business. 6 years later, Macquarie decided not only to keep my role, but to extend it and made me continental head for all of the activities in Africa. In 2015, Macquarie, as global organizations are wont to do, decided that it would be a good idea to consolidate all of their interests in South Africa. So they disposed of their joint venture with Old Mutual, the infrastructure fund, which was the first initiative they had in South Africa, and bought J&J First South out of the joint venture, becoming wholly owned. At that point in time, I decided it was better to go out on my own. Didn't really want to work for a large international organization without equity. So we parted ways amicably, and Macquarie is now a wholly owned South African entity, and that essentially ended my career in 2015 with them.
Okay, okay. So how did the relationship with Huge come about? You obviously back in the 1990s were writing about analyzing technology companies, writing reports on them. So you obviously had some sort of affinity for the sector. You've decided to return to the telecommunications space. How did this arrangement come about? How did you come to join Huge Group as chairman?
Well, when I was extricating myself out of Macquarie, one of the aspirations was that I was going to launch a SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company. And in fact, Macquarie and a number of my staff were involved in doing a few of those transactions. The capital markets were looking really good in 2015. And it really looked like an environment where I thought now with my history as an IT analyst and then as a financier, and that looking at the fintech space in particular, that you know the, where there's a convergence of financials and IT, that this was a perfect environment. James saw the announcement that essentially I was departing Macquarie, phoned me about 30 nanoseconds later, and we had breakfast. We'd known each other for something like 20 years, put an intriguing proposition together. I went away and thought about it over December. Mr. Nene got fired by Mr. Zuma. The capital markets imploded. And I said, I reverted back to James. I thought, potentially, not only is this something interesting for me to do because I like your proposition and I like what you guys are anticipating, but potentially, you know, I can add sufficient value and this could potentially be me a vehicle for my own aspirations in this particular space. Again, taking the 20 years of experience that I've had.
What was that proposition that attracted you?
Well, James, initially at that stage, James said, look, all I want is 6 days of your time.
Right.
After about 2 months of working with James, I came to understand that that wasn't 6 days a year, it was 6 days a week. So I started working quite closely with James. As I started working with him, you know, it started to evolve that this was, pardon the pun, but it was huge and it was much bigger than I anticipated in terms of the prospect and this canvas. So we started working together and developing the various areas of expansion, the organic and acquisitive opportunities. And as I got sucked into this together with Zenaid, who started roughly around about the same time, started to just get sucked in and enthusiastic. And in fact, I had 5 or 6 other initiatives that have literally been shelved because I just don't have time. Because literally, I am non-executive, but literally am putting a lot of time and effort because of the excitement an opportunity that I see. I mean, we can get into some of the specifics.
Are you likely to become a full-time executive employee of the business at some point?
I don't like the idea, you know, having worked for 20 years formally in the financial services industry. I mean, maybe it's just fictitious in my mind, but, you know, for intensive purposes, you know, putting 20, 30 hours in a week for Huge, you know, I quite like the flexibility that the non-executive title brings. And it's all, you know, the reality is that I'm enjoying it. You know, the independence that I have is still very positive. And who knows, you know, where the path will lead us. But right now, I think that the structure is suitable to us both.
Okay. James, let's talk a bit about where the business is going. I think many people, you know, this industry has been through enormous change over the last decade. Huge Group was founded when? 2007?
2007 it listed. So 8th of August 2007.
Okay, listed entity for 10 years now. I think when the bottom dropped out of the least cost routing market, I think many people thought, well, you know, Huge Group plays in that space. The future can't be that bright. But the share price has rallied, I think, something like 500% over the last 5 years. You're obviously the one having the last laugh now about this.
Finally.
Did you have to reimagine this business in the wake of what happened in the LCR market, and how did you do it?
I think we sat down at the same time in the same basket as everybody else in terms of understanding that least cost routing was collapsing and that we needed to do something about it. I think what the vast majority of the commentators out there saw and what the vast majority of the other participants saw was a collapsing market, and I think they generalized. And we interrogated the least cost routing market, I think, in a little bit more detail in terms of trying to understand what it actually meant. And after some serious analysis on it, we realized that least cost routing had a technology component and it had a commercial component. And that what was being made defunct at the time was the commercial model. And that at a technology level, least cost routing in terms of what was used in least cost routing was alive and well. Mm. It was just the commercials were not conducive to delivering that technology out in the market. And then on a lot of thinking and trying to forecast what the market would do over 5 to 10 years. And I mean, we were forecasting that far out. And I mean, where we sit today, that's exactly what has happened. We realized that at a technology level, the solution that GSM brought to the market was a very viable solution, and that ultimately our view that it could be a substitute for Telkom's copper cables, if not a better alternative than Telkom's copper cables, we started realizing that that was a very viable proposition. And so we set about trying to put a plan together. Now, that plan has taken 10 years to bring to fruition and to make it a success. But we saw it then, 10 years ago. And it was just a process. We had to run a gauntlet. We understood that. Commercially, we had to run a gauntlet. And various things happened along the way. And, you know, we would have liked in retrospect to have seen the successes earlier and see the structural changes in the market earlier. Those didn't take place, but it's all come together now. Mm. 10 years later, but we could see that. So, you know, the model was defunct and it had to be rebuilt, re-engineered, and we did that. And we went about our business doing that. So the share price appreciation is just a reflection of what we've built. Mm. At a fundamental level, it represents the fundamental characteristics of what we've put together, and that it is a viable proposition. So share price is just reflecting what we've done, I believe.
Take us through the huge business. What is your main money spinner? What is it that you offer customers specifically when you go out and see a client? What are you selling to them specifically?
So I think what we've got to do is we've got to have a look at what we were literally 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. and what we are building going forward. Those are two distinct businesses. So historically, we've been building a business focused in the connectivity space around voice and around GSM, which is wireless. Going forward, our aspirations are far bigger than that, and so we have augmented that connectivity portfolio of voice with an expanded product set of connectivity around a number of other services. So our acquisition in March, that we closed in March, of ConnectNet Broadband Wireless, which is a payment gateway business, which we have now renamed to Huge Connect. That is testimony now to building out the thematic, which is a connectivity thematic, and that can span the basket of connectivity players and then goes into Internet of Things and fintech as your more blue sky that we're obviously trying to map out where we go on those. And then, so that's the forward position of what we're building. Historically, what we've had is we've had a one-trick pony, a very good one-trick pony, and that business has been centered around providing a voice or telephony solution to the South African corporate market primarily, and because of default, not by design, primarily at the SME level. Mm-hmm. Because margins are better at that level than at the enterprise level. So one has to have a look at both scenarios, what we were and what we are aspiring to become. Mm. So what we were is we were 10 years ago, or I mean the underlying businesses are 25 years old. The original business, if I can reference it as such, the original business was about providing a cost saving for telephony. And it was implemented, that cost saving was implemented or generated for customers by putting in certain technology. So it was very niched, very focused at the time. Be that as it may, though, it grew into a significantly sized industry. I think at one stage, pre the collapse of commercial LCR, or least cost routing, that industry was about a 3.6 billion rand industry, which is, you know, certainly not, it's not massive, but it was a significant niche in the overall telecommunication sector. So it was primarily focused around voice and outbound telephony and providing a cost saving, but on a commercial model that required the participants to go into the ordinary consumer market for GSM, buy a consumer product, and then unpack that product to try and emulate the wholesale product. So what you did was you went around to Vodacom, MTN, Cell C, and you subscribed for one of their packages. And because you were bulk buying, you would get a discount. And in those days, we had something, you still have it today, but it's called a terminal equipment subsidy. In those days, it was called a connection incentive bonus.
Yes.
And you would use that ultimately to lower your cost structure and derive a cost structure. Be that as it may, though, it was a retail minus commercial model.
Mm.
And that is ultimately what became defunct, because when the South African telecommunications regulator, ICASA, the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, decided to lower the cost of voice communication in South Africa, it then set about a glide path on wholesale costs, which was referred to at the time as termination rates and a termination rate glide path. And so it started reducing these wholesale costs. And as a result of reducing these wholesale costs, the bigger operators were impacted by that cost reduction and so sought to reclaim margin elsewhere in the industry. And the least cost routing operators were seen as the easy pickings. And so the very first thing that happened was post the glide path being communicated, which was in 2009, in 2010, what you started seeing was the mobile operators now removing margin from least cost routing. And the first phase of that was the removal or the collapse of the connection incentive bonus, which was a significant amount of money. And to put that in perspective, we were generating, we being Huge Telecom, were generating about 600 million rands worth of airtime revenue in those days for Vodacom, MTN, Cell C. And we would, if you looked at a 12-month period, we were on average generating about 54 million rand. So close to 10% of our margin was derived from connection incentive bonuses. And that was taken away.
It disappeared.
It was 30 days notice and it collapsed. So that ultimately started the demise. And I mean, you saw those big billboards go up where LCR was seen as prehistoric. And that was because of the collapse of the commercial model. But the technology model stayed intact.
I mean, this must have hit you guys very hard. I mean, what was the mood like around here when that happened?
Well, I can tell you that when we got the letters, and we got the letters 2 days apart, one from Vodacom, one from MTN, giving us 30 days notice. We convened, I think that would have been midweek. I mean, I can't remember the exact days, but midweek, and that required us to convene a special board meeting the week later.
Mm-hmm.
And at that board meeting, I was asked to reduce the headcount immediately, and that was to take it from 235 people down half. So 118 odd people, they wanted an immediate reduction in headcount. And jokes aside, it was literally just go 13579, and whoever falls into that bucket, the headcount loss. So it was catastrophic. It was a complete collapse of the business. I can remember going into one of the operators, and I won't mention which operator, but putting my keys down on the table and saying, here you go, and my counterpart asking what that was, and I said, well, it's the keys to the front door. you can lock it on Monday evening. So that's how bad it was. Mm. It was a complete collapse.
Mm. So picking up the pieces from that must have been quite difficult.
Yeah. So then we had a look at it, and you spend weeks, months going through a strategic analysis, an economic analysis, and trying to picture where this was going to all go. And whether the best decision wasn't at that point in time just to shut it down. I mean, that was one of the options. And whether we could see light at the end of the tunnel. So after much analysis, we realized, hang on, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and here is the makings of a plan. It wasn't going to be easy. We had to do various things, and we did. I mean, in terms of headcount, 6 months later, we had we probably had 140 people. 12 months later, we had 105. And so we re-engineered the business, and we put plans in place, and we started going after things and asking for things and negotiating things that we thought we needed to be able to be successful. And that, again, post that period was another, you know, that's an entire story on its own, is all the building blocks that we had to put together. So as an example on the headcount reduction that was required, on that board meeting, I came back after that board meeting. We convened another board meeting 2 weeks later, and the board said to me, "What's your plan?" I said, "Well, my plan is I'm going to reduce headcount and sales." They said, "Oh, you're smoking your socks. You cut your back end, not your front end." And I said, "No, I'm going to have to cut the front end. I need to keep the back end intact in terms of delivery." So unfortunately, everybody in sales has got to go. And we had about 50, 60 salespeople. They all had to go. Predominantly, we tried to redeploy as many people as we could. And we focused on delivering a back office solution that could stand the test of time in the market. So we changed our approach from sales to service. So that was one of the first things in this whole long journey that we changed. And then we said, well, if we're not going to have a sales department, well, what are we going to do? And this is part of what defines us today. So at that point in time, we said, we're not going to have a direct sales force. We're going to have an indirect sales force. So we're going to go to third parties to sell our product. And that was a defining moment. And if you look today, we have over 650 resellers. And we've had to sign 650 pieces of paper. We've had to negotiate them. Now, that doesn't take a month. Mm. That takes months upon months and upon months. And when you look at what we have today, that becomes now an important facet of what we have today and why there is value in what we have. And that is because of those hard, long yards, putting those together. So I reckon we probably in the telecommunications space, as Huge Group, Huge Telecom, have one of the best distribution channels in the market. Now, if you're able to bring product to that distribution, which we sit in a position today where we can, and there's some exciting stuff we'd like to tell you about, then the value of that, decision that was made 8 years ago, is appreciated. Mm. So there are a lot of things that took place in this re-engineering, probably, you know, more than I can count on two hands in terms of trying to think of things that we had to do to be able to sit in the position we sit today.
So you work mainly now through a distribution channel, whereas before you were mainly direct?
So we worked probably on the numbers. 80% of our sales 10 years ago were generated internally. Mm-hmm. 20% from a reseller channel. Again, when you look at those strategies and you analyze them, one of the questions that you ask yourself at the time is, should we be competing with our channel? Should we be competing with our reseller market? And we realized we can't run a direct sales force. So I couldn't sit with a position where I reduced my internal sales force from 60 people to 10 and then try to build a relationship of loyalty and trust with resellers if I was still going to retain some form of competition against my resellers. So those are very difficult decisions, but if you think about them strategically, then you appreciate the importance of some very simple concepts like trust and loyalty. So for us, that was the marker. Mm. How do we create a loyal and trustworthy i.e. where we are seen, trustworthy position, where we are seen as a party that we can trust. So one of the outcomes of that decision was we would never go into the market for selling PABXs. So VoIP became Voice over IP, Voice over Internet Protocol, became a difficult proposition for us because ultimately if you play in that space, you participate in the resale of PABXs in the cloud, and therefore you compete with the very people you're asking to sell your product. So I think we sit in an enviable position today where we have created this very strong position of trust and loyalty, because we don't compete with the channel. And the channel primarily distributes PABX's office automation, and we've built that out over the years. So again, there's another factor there that was important in the story.
Just as a matter of interest, when I'm driving around Johannesburg, I see a huge group vans everywhere.
Yes.
Are those yours vans, or are those partner vans?
Those are all ours. So the service element of the business is delivered by Huge Telecom, the sales by third-party distributors.
Okay.
So we do the entire back end, all the client equipment that's out there.
Yeah.
We have 40,000 telephone lines. We have 40,000 devices. That is all managed by Huge Telecom staff. Mm. And that's to ensure, so again, another important tenet of our business model was standards and consistency. And so that was an important factor. We said the only way we can achieve a consistent service that has a particular standard is if we do it ourselves. At a sales level, we're happy to, you know, we're happy for third parties to get involved and sell in the style with which they're accustomed. But in our case, at a service level, we need to ensure that we create those standards. And so no installations are done other than through and by Huge Telecom.
Okay. What percentage of your business is voice as opposed to other services?
So of Huge Telecom, so this is pre the acquisition of Huge Connect.
Yes.
Is 100% a voice-only business. There is no provision of data. So we don't provide data to the market, which again, now looking at it today, is a significant opportunity for us. We've got inside Huge Telecom, and this is ignoring Huge Connect for a moment, we've got 15,000 customers where we provide a voice solution and a voice solution only. But there is an ability to provide a data solution. So again, there's some exciting opportunities in that. In acquiring Huge Connect, we've got another 30,000 customers who don't have a voice product and don't have a data product, but have a payment connectivity product. So again, there's opportunities in that client base. I mean, we have, in total now, we have 45,000 SME customers. It's probably one of the larger SME customer bases around. We talk to them every month because we bill them every month. Mm. So the value in that billing relationship, again, cannot be underestimated. So that's another point in terms of what we're presenting to the market today, which we think is partially reflected in the share price today, and why we've seen that appreciation, you know, over the last 5 years from whatever the lows were to where we are now.
Dwight, maybe I can ask you to jump in at this point. Obviously, the telecommunications industry is in a state of flux. I think it's always been in a state of flux. But we're seeing a marked shift now from voice to data being the major proposition, certainly in the consumer space. What do you see as the opportunity for Huge in that area? I mean, do you need to expand your propositions in the data market? Is it an opportunity that could deliver the sort of margins that you've experienced in the voice side in the future? Do you need to make acquisitions to play in that space? What are the allied opportunities around that?
Well, first of all, I think that James brought me on board specifically to look to help a little bit with the strategy, a little bit with, I guess, a lot on the M&A side, collectively. Sure. to look at that. So, first of all, South Africa generally is a small economy. So I think, firstly, that one has to diversify in terms of product. So I think what James had was a fantastic and is a fantastic business that can double and double again. We have, but in order to diversify the business, I think it was important in terms of being able to, A, cross-sell, and two, also just to limit specific risk. The other thing is that if we look at telecommunications, that's a general word, but firstly is we're not an infrastructure business, and I like to compare this industry to the mining industry. In 1886, someone went and found a piece of gold. For the next 20 years, people spent an enormous amount of money sinking holes. The next phase that came through, yes, those guys had to sell, but to compete with a mine owner that had already made a significant investment was very difficult. Mm. Well, you had to come, you know, you had to bring a lot of money to the table. So the next wave was really the service providers. we're seeing, that first wave has happened. You know, we've got a trillion dollar industry in the telco space. The next level is the services layer, and this is where we have elected to pick to play. So voice is one of the products. The payment connectivity is another. And, you know, we were talking previously, Internet of Things. You know, these are all mobility services, over-the-top applications. These are all things that have a modern precedent in terms of what's happening in the next revolution of technology that we want to play. The other thing that I often say is actually we're not a telco business, we're a real estate business. We've got 45,000 customers. To put that in perspective, Standard Bank, which is, you know, arguably number one, number two bank in South Africa, only has 65,000 SME clients. So we're almost bank sized in terms of our SME base.
Wow.
We're only providing, in each instance, one product. And then people talk about convergence as if it's the holy grail. It's convergence of the bill. The client, especially SME, wants to be serviced properly, doesn't want to be treated by a call center as if he was a consumer. Mm. And on the other side, the service provider can't treat them as an enterprise client because they'll never get a return. We've had discussions with people who say, listen, you know, to service SME, everyone talks about them, but it isn't a DNA. James has built a business whose DNA is SME. So we want to expand that customer base in SME and diversify our product offering. Voice, yes, is not the high growth area, but it is a market that will never go away. I mean, we were having a preliminary discussion with an asset manager last year, and the guy said, this is old crap. This is nonsense. We want to be out of this particular market. You know, what are you selling me this nonsense for? I've converted our entire product to voice over IP. As he said that, the call went dead. Couldn't get him on the phone. So we had to use our cell phones to phone him up. And the guy said, gee, I don't know what happened. I said, I'll tell you what happened. Someone downloaded Debbie Does Investments in your back office. And your entire system collapsed because what you haven't got is segregation. So you want to have a voice service. And you so the client doesn't really care if there's three pieces of kit. They'll probably want one billing relationship. But the other thing that they want to do is redundancy and make sure that, you know, something goes down with data. Mm. And what James has built is a voice product that requires very low service touch. What he didn't say is that of 15,000 clients, he gets less than probably 10 or 12 service calls a month. If you've got a voice over IP offering, it's fantastic. But, you know, if something goes down, the intercomplication of the system, you know, it means that you've probably got to send a high-value resource to kind of resolve the problem. So that's, I mean, the one of the key prospects that we have. In terms of diversifying our offering, I mean, the business we bought with ConnectNet is a fabulous business. It's a fantastic business. It is one of the top three players in the market. Our two biggest competitors are owned by Telkom and Vodacom, respectively. And I always say that we've actually got into the payment space by identifying a connectivity player. I mean, the payments, the retail payment space is a trillion rand a year industry. Mm. Only 40% is handled by credit cards. 60% is still cash. So there's still growth in that market. And we are probably, through our system, we probably have 50 or 60 billion rand a month worth of transactions that are going through our system. So it's a massive infrastructure that we've got. I mean, what can you tag onto that? Certainly selling data products, certainly selling asset tracking products, certainly broadening our SME base. These are all wonderful opportunities that the new age of technology is opening to us. It really is as exciting as the 90s for me, where everyone was using the wrong metric because PE ratios just were no longer valid. So PEG came in to try and explain the acceleration of the businesses. And I think today PEG is now incapable of valuing these telco businesses and these fintech businesses.
So, Dwight, are there any disadvantages to not being an infrastructure player?
Well, the bottom line, if you own the infrastructure, clearly you have an advantage. I mean, the only problem with being in the infrastructure is the sheer scale of it. When you look at the amount of capex. Mm. I mean, look at what I think Telkom put 2 or 3 billion rand of its capex into fiber to the home and fiber to the business last year.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, Vodacom and MTN, I mean, not to segregate, but they're putting 8 or 10 billion rand each. I mean, you've now seen this new incumbent come to the party, Rain, which is part of the multi-source stable. I mean, they've just raised 1.5 billion rand, and I mean, they've got some fantastic offerings there. But again, you know, in order to capitalize on that spectrum, there will be a large need for capital investment. Mm. And, you know, if you're in the game, you need to spend the loot, you know, just to keep up. Again, you know, what we've seen with infrastructure players, technology changes happen quickly and unpredictably. And then the risk to an infrastructure owner is that you get leapfrogged. And I guess that's what Rain is threatening to do with all the other players. But, you know, in 5 years' time, I really can't project what the next role will be there in terms of technology and whether there is actually value to being the incumbent. I mean, another large player is Dark Fiber Africa. Liquid is playing in this game. So there are a lot of players with a lot of pockets. And if you've got that type of capital to spend, then you've got to find a designated area. I mean, there's a lot of question marks whether you know, fiber is the ultimate way to go, or whether 4G, 5G, 6G is going to be ultimately the winner. The answer is probably all of the above.
Are people taking bets on them? I'm really interested in that Vumatel story about them going into townships.
Well, you know, I live in Ilova, and the central road there's been dug up 3 times by various fiber operators, all competing for the same probably 1,000 houses in the district. And if I can work out what it costs to provide me fiber, I think it's going to take a couple of years for them to get a return of investment, let alone a return on investment. And then they're not the only player. So, yeah, I can see there's a race for a land grab there, but I'm struggling with the commerciality there. And then, of course, now you've got a product there that is essentially wireless that is offering the same throughput. So very tough. Very tough.
I do want to, before we wrap up today, I do want to get your views on the broad telecommunications industry in South Africa. But before we get there, James, I want to ask you a bit about going back to the voice business. Termination rates have come down dramatically over the years. They're due to come down again, I think, on the 1st of October or the 1st of November this year. They really have come down significantly. Will this further reduction have any impact on Huge Group or the industry more broadly?
Yes, it will specifically have an effect on Huge Telecom. And the reason for that is 4 or 5 years ago, in moving from a retail minus commercial model of lease cost routing, we moved into a wholesale format and a wholesale arrangement with the operators, where we would acquire ultimately minutes on a pure per second basis in a wholesale cost plus format. So on that basis, if a portion of the wholesale cost drops, and there are two pieces to there are two parts to making a telephone call. One is your originating part, and the other is your terminating part. Now, the terminating part is regulated in South Africa, and as you say, that comes down. And then the originating part you negotiate with the operator. So with the terminating rate coming down, we'll naturally benefit from that. That will in turn allow us at an originating leg to have a negotiation, because in theory, from an economic theory perspective, is origination and termination are two sides of the same coin. In theory, they should be exactly the same price. So if you're paying 10 cents to terminate a fixed line call, you should be paying 10 cents to originate a fixed line call. They should largely be the same cost. We see those costs coming down over time. Whether they get to an economic zero position, I think it's a matter of when it happens rather than if it happens. So we are going to keep going down that curve.
When you say an economic zero position, do you mean 0 cents, no termination fee?
I.e. no termination fees, which would then by implication mean no origination fees, which means you've got a zero cost base, okay? And then what that is doing is that is pushing the margin into the service layer, because the infrastructure layer has then been at an economic level. You've reached perfection in terms of competition, and it's been fully commoditized. And now you move it into where the value is really being added, which is at the service layer. And that's to touch on what Dart's saying. That's why we've decided to focus on the service layer, is that margin will ultimately be pushed into that segment of the market. So yes, the cost curve at a voice level continues to fall, but then it continues to fall in data as well. So telecommunications transmission is being commoditized every single day, and the cost curve is dropping. And there's now a transfer of value from the infrastructure layer of the market into the service layer of the market. And we're playing there, we're participating there, and we're benefiting there. Mm. I mean, we're direct beneficiaries of that.
Okay. Just before we wrap up, I'm keen to get both of your views on, just broadly, on the state of the telecommunications market in South Africa. Dwight, you mentioned there's been a heck of a lot of investment. Liquid Telecom, of course, coming into this market, Blue Label helping to recapitalize Cell C. So the dynamics of the big infrastructure players is changing. Just broadly, where do you think this industry is? And I know this is a very broad question, so maybe it's not really fair, but Dwight, where do you think the industry is going to be in 5 years' time? Are we going to see a wave of consolidation between these infrastructure players? I mean, just listening to you talking about the fiber example of three players coming up your street, that's surely not sustainable. Does there need to be consolidation in the space? And yeah, just your view of where it's going to be a few years out.
Look, I think it's been a fantastic 22, 23 odd years. 1994, I got my first cell phone. I mean, just look at where that happened. But I think that it's a little bit like the early days when Intel came out, where the chip started doubling in capacity every 24 months, Moore's law, but the price was halving. So I think you're still seeing this insatiable demand for connectivity. I mean, if you look at the connectivity of the South Africans to the internet, if you look at some of the recent reports, it's still tremendously low. So there's still a big opportunity. The demand for data is going to be driven by cleverer and cleverer applications that bring things to, you know, there's lots of reports been written about the bottom billions, but really now providing services to the poorer end of the spectrum that were only available to the more affluent people. Mm-hmm. And that is done through the connectivity being extended further and further till everyone has access to that. And we're only halfway done. Mm-hmm. You know, so the next 5 years, I think we're going to continue to see a land grab. You're going to continue to see data prices tumbling, but data usage exponentially increasing. All that it was what Intel giveth, Microsoft taketh away. I think that is still true about mobility, and I think that is essentially going to drive the requirement. So you're going to see an increase in infrastructure. And even the data prices are coming up, the utilization of data sets that off. And I don't see an end to that because, I mean, the number of applications, the interesting things that I can see done on top of that infrastructure just increases. So we work on top of that layer. And we're very excited about what's happening here and internationally. So where's it going? I still see another several years of aggressive growth. Consolidation, yes, must happen. But I do think that also is going to be a proliferation of new technologies. I mean, that potentially are going to leapfrog some of the current incumbents. So that is the unpredictable nature. And then where to from there? So the next 5 years will be an area of a continued investment, a continued growth of data utilization, and then the proliferation, I think, of applications.
James, your thoughts?
I think just at a very simplistic level, you're sitting, certainly in terms of telecommunications, you're sitting, and particularly mobile, wireless, you're sitting with a 25-year-old industry. Banking's 4,000 or 5,000 years old, and the banks seem to today make more money than they used to 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. So you've got telecommunications, mobile telecommunications, 25 years old. You've got the smartphone that's only 10 years old. You've got the dawn of the Internet of Things. Quantum physics is probably going to play a large part going forward in terms of redefining computing power. So you mix that all up. For me, you have a cocktail that will provide significant growth going forward. I think we've only begun to imagine what we're going to be able to do. And, I mean, just our experiences with the smartphone today and the efficiencies that it has brought to everyday living, I think we're only scratching the surface. I mean, 10 years ago, I still had to ask for directions. Now I don't. I, you know, 10 years ago, I had to negotiate a taxi fare today I don't. The world is changing, and I think what underlies that is the importance of being connected. So connectivity as a thematic is, I think it's here to stay, and I think it's a very high growth area. There are going to be the winners and losers. I think you're going to have to continually re-engineer your businesses in particular areas, and that requires intellectual property. And your earlier question at the start, why bring all these very capable, very clever people on board? Well, if you're going to play in this industry and in this thematic that will experience constant change, you need people that can think ahead of the game. So that's how I characterize telecommunications. Now, whether in the next 2 years we have significant consolidation in infrastructure or that happens 8 years from now, again, the given is something is going to happen and things are going to remold and reshape over time. But the underlying position is it is a very exciting space with significant growth, and we think that's the place to be over and above any other industry, whether that be mining or banking. We think connectivity and telecommunications is the place to be. It is the new order. And so that's our play.
And you're right, Duarte, about how it's filtering down to everyone, because, you know, 2 years ago you see commuters getting off a taxi that will be using little Samsungs or Nokias. Now they're all using smartphones. So the technology is getting cheaper and it's filtering down to everyone, which must uplift the whole economy, I guess.
Well, I mean, the key axis here, I think the key challenge is to provide financial services to through this connectivity to people who don't have access to it. And that's why, I mean, you know, we often laugh and say, what the hell is fintech? Well, fintech is the convergence of technology and financial to provide some disruptive service. And at the end of the day, as I say, you know, this was the domain where only the rich could afford it. We still have half of our population that can't afford to do the internet access. Hmm. I mean, half the population does not have internet access. That's crazy. And then you put, you know, a payment solution, and they still carry cash. They get robbed. Why? You know, there's got to be an opportunity to offer a cheap electronic. They already have it. It's called prepaid airtime.
Hmm.
it's essentially a deposit. I don't care what the regulator calls it. You just can't use it to buy something else at this point in time. So all of that is now just needs to mature. And I think this is where government's going to have a very important role. And I know that financial services and telecoms is highly regulated for good reason, because there's always someone trying to do someone in. But at the end of the day, they are obligated to come up with regulations that facilitate the participation of these players so that they can extend their service offerings to people. I mean, you look at, I think it is India that has actually created a common platform for banks and fintech operators to operate. That's forward thinking, rather than trying to paralyze the new players with old-fashioned old-fashioned regulations. So our government has got a very important role to play here. And they should be a facilitator, not an inhibitor of what's going to happen in the future.
Gentlemen, this has been a fascinating discussion. Duarte Silva is chairman and James Herbst is CEO of Huge Group. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast today.